Well, people sometimes say to me, "Well, what do you have? A conspiracy theory? Do you think these leaders are just deliberately trying to manipulate the whole world just to suit themselves?" What do you say?
Yes.
Conspiracy theorists. How do you like that? I mean, you think there's actually a group of men sitting in a room who sit there and are plotting these things for some reason? Do you hear that? You have that up here? You think there's a group of people sitting around in a room? But somehow that image is supposed to be very compelling, you know? So improbable. And I always say, "Oh, no, no, they don't sit around in a room. They meet on carousels and they talk to each other that way." Right. Or they do, what do they call that? Free-falling. No, with the parachute guys, they all lock arms. You see those parachutes? What? Skydivers. They all skydive. You see them locking arms. What do you think they're talking about when they're all locked arms like that? That's where they meet. Of course they meet in rooms. Where the hell else do you think they're going to meet? They have...
Good afternoon, good evening, or good morning, whatever's appropriate where you are. My name is Louis Alday. I'm a longtime friend and supporter of Sina and the podcast. In a separate episode that's going to be released alongside this one, me and Sina discuss at length a website that I launched earlier this year called Liberated Texts. But by way of a short introduction, if you can't listen to that episode, Liberated Texts is a book review website, but not for new books, for works that have been overlooked or ignored, forgotten or misinterpreted in some way since their release. Although not exclusively, we're largely interested in works relating to imperialism, colonialism, and the history of communist and revolutionary movements around the world. It launched in March of this year, and it already has several very interesting reviews of a pretty diverse range of texts. One such text is Peter Dale Scott's 2007 work, The Road to 9/11, reviewed by Patrick Higgins. Seeing as it's the 20th anniversary of the attacks and 9/11 is such a difficult subject to have a serious and honest discussion about, I thought that doing so with Patrick and using his brilliant review of Scott's book as a starting point to do so would make for a very interesting conversation. So I'm pleased to say Patrick is here with me today. So Patrick, do you want to say a few words just to introduce yourself?
Yes, thanks a lot, Louis. I appreciate it. I appreciate Sana for giving us the kind of space that we have on this show to be able to discuss this. But yeah, like Louis said, I'm Patrick Higgins. I'm actually a PhD candidate at the University of Houston. And what I write about is a little bit different from Peter Dale Scott's book. That's actually part of what appealed about writing about this book for me. But my actual research is on perspectives within the Palestinian Revolution between the 1950s, 1970s on U.S. imperialism. That is both the theoretical perspectives and how those theories might have informed revolutionary strategy and the debates that happen about the question of U.S. imperialism and its role in the Arab region and Palestine as well. But more generally, yeah, I'm a writer, historian, and so yeah, I think that about covers it.
Thanks a lot, Patrick. So just as a real basic question, also out of curiosity, genuine curiosity as well, how did you first come across this book? Do you remember how? Because I'm ashamed to say that I hadn't heard of it until you suggested to review it for Liberated Texts. And I was very happy when you did, because from a quick glance, I could tell it was important. So yeah, could you talk a little bit about how and when you came across it?
Well, what I'll say is that, again, this book is, its methodology and overall project is a little bit different from what I normally write about, but actually only tangentially, because in general, I'm interested in questions of imperialism, and I'm interested, of course, in U.S. imperialism specifically in figuring out ways to oppose it. And within my interests in imperialism, there's different aspects that we can kind of focus on, right? There's this aspect we can understand it from Marxist and theoretical perspectives about value transfers and why some countries are rich and some countries are poor. And for me, that those kind of questions form the fulcrum, I think, of what's important to understand about imperialism as a system. But there is this other aspect of it that you if you are anti-imperialist, you have to deal with this no matter what. There's no way to avoid it, which is understanding imperialism through its concrete as opposed to abstract connections and manifestations and how it carries out, how the system perpetuates itself by carrying out specific deeds. So if you're writing about imperialism in a contemporary sense as it unfolds, let's say, for instance, we want to understand something specific, like what the United States might be up to in Syria, we start to see that a large portion of what imperialism carries out in the world actually happens by covert means. And at some point, I think because the covert aspect of imperialism makes things very difficult to specify and to talk about, I started to turn towards the kind of literature that exists of the covert arms of imperialism, let's say, during what we might call the Cold War, or what I think just is easily be called the U.S. Global War of Recolonization. There was one book that I had read some years ago about Operation Gladio, for instance, essentially going into what is known. And again, there's a problem here about what can be known because we have limited access to documents. So we have to make do with what we have.
Patrick, do you want to just very quickly, if you can, explain, in case listeners aren't aware, what Operation Gladio was? Just in very simple terms.
Yeah, in the most basic terms, what happened, you know, after the Second World War and the United States is sort of coming towards the head of the world system, the United States set up a repressive infrastructure. Gladio primarily refers to Western Europe, but includes Turkey, Italy, and further west as well. Gladio is this system of quote unquote stay behind secret armies that could carry out direct attacks through secretive means on working class movements as well as communist movements that might challenge U.S. attempts to gain hegemony in Europe. And so I became very interested in that. And I just wanted to know, how could we supplement our theoretical understanding of, let's say, global class relations, again, which countries are rich and which countries are poor, with an empirical understanding of imperialism and its repressive apparatus, which necessarily entails a covert arm. And I found that search into that kind of research led me to the work of Peter Dale Scott, because he had been talking for a long time about deep politics in the quote-unquote deep state, which, you know, since he was working and using the term, has taken on new connotations and meanings, which we could talk about. But what he was doing was kind of showing me what research into the secretive affairs of a system literally run on secrecy and clandestinism work, and how we could sort of trace our steps. And again, I find this important because if a good deal of imperialist operations operate in secret, then we need some sort of literature, and we need some sort of approach to be able to deal with that, find out what we can, and explain to people. And again, this is a question of how we can prove what we know. I mean, I guess the line of deep politics comes down to a simple question. There's what we think we know and what we do know. And we can only make credible claims about what we think we know. Like, you know,
careful, you might sound like Rumsfeld in a second.
Yeah, well, but this is important because what I'm thinking about is like, okay, so you have, if we're dealing with an unfolding covert war in Syria, and none of the details have been released to the public yet, we can make informed speculation about that war, but we also have to be able to find out what we can to support that. So again, there's what you think you know, but you base what you think you know on what you do know. And, you know, in the case of for instance, the U.S. war in Syria, there's a long record of CIA covert operations to support the kind of forces they were supporting there as a counter-revolutionary force. So that's what led me to Peter Dale Scott, the kind of the broader questions I was asking myself.
Just one thing I was going to add regarding Operation Gladio. I mean, there's more than one book about Gladio, but one of the most comprehensive is by Daniele Ganser, if anyone's interested in reading it. And he shows very clearly, like Patrick said, how across Western Europe and beyond, these secretive so-called stay behind armies that were supposedly created to fight in case of a Soviet invasion were actually, and they were mainly manned by fascists and in some cases literal Nazis. Ganser shows very clearly how they were used as a counter-revolutionary, counter-communist force and were involved in a number of false flag terrorist attacks, which were then blamed on leftist and communist movements across Europe, especially in Italy, to discredit communist movements, basically. So my next question, you've already kind of begun to discuss, but could you just say a little bit about the author, Peter Dale Scott, and who he is? You've mentioned that he writes about deep politics, but could you maybe elaborate a little bit?
What I can say about Peter Dale Scott is he's a poet, a longtime professor, as well as a one-time Canadian diplomat. But where he comes from as a historical scholar is, I think, like millions, that he was outraged by the war on Vietnam and was moved to try to understand the military mechanisms and business relations that were in place that ended up leading to this this war on the Vietnamese Revolution. And so I think that first set him on the trail of theorizing what he eventually refers to as the deep state, but he's actually borrowing that term from the Turkish left to understand the networks that you were just talking about, Operation Gladio. So he ended up writing a series of books about war on Vietnam, how these same secretive networks that he was talking about, which were really established at an industrial scale in the United States after the Second World War as a result of the 1947 National Security Act. So that's the act that, for instance, would give us the Central Intelligence Agency. And of course, they keep adding agencies on semi-annual basis, you know. But he becomes interested in the workings of imperialism's secretive repressive apparatus, which would include assassinations, would include the kind of sinister operations that you were just describing relating to Gladio. It would include also illicit trades, because the personnel that develop through the secretive networks that are protected, their secrecy is protected by the imperialist state, move illicit products like guns, drugs. And he has been writing about these issues essentially from the war on Vietnam through his investigations into the John F. Kennedy assassination, into Iran-Contra, and later on to understand and essentially offer a political genealogy of 9/11 and its aftermath. And so I think that is how we could understand his interests. I would say about that, and the major difference between Peter Dale Scott and myself politically is that he has, through despite everything and damning he's discovered and everything damning he's written about, has maintained the position of what I would call an honest liberal and not necessarily a political radical. An honest liberal as somebody who sort of critiques the United States in order to save the United States. So that gives you a broad overview. But this, in my opinion, does not mean that his investigations into the clandestine networks of imperialism's repressive apparatus are not important or something.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, one thing that I find quite striking and interesting about Peter Dale Scott, And it's something I've noticed in other writers, including academics, that are less afraid to touch subjects that others don't want to, is that it's often not formally within the discipline with which they were or are employed. So, you know, he was a professor of English. He was not, for example, a political scientist, quote unquote. And I think it's maybe interesting to think that the fact that he was working to some extent outside of his discipline maybe gave him more freedom to do so. And I mean, also there's the fact that I think he's now very old. I think he's possibly even in his 90s.
In his 90s, yeah.
I think he, you know, nominally he retired in the 90s, but he's obviously carried on working. And in fact, a lot of his, so for example, the book we're going to discuss was written a long time after he formally retired. So maybe also having one foot outside of academia also gave him more freedom of movement to actually look at these things critically. I don't know.
I think so. Yeah, I think you tap into a really important point there, because what I find in my personal experience is that when you are talking about what issues or topics might get you censured, so to speak, from professional academia, a lot of times it has to do with the concrete. That is, you're more likely, we could kind of condemn systems broadly and abstractly, but when we start saying X is delivering funds to Y to accomplish Z, and you're naming names and you're naming institutions, yeah, that's when I think the heat comes a little close to home.
Exactly. It's very easy to oppose imperialism in the abstract. To move actually to the book, which, to give it its full title, which I didn't earlier, is The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America. Obviously, it's difficult to distill a fairly lengthy book down into not too much information, but could you outline what is the central premise of Scott's book?
Yeah, so the central premise is, of course, there are different components to the book, and I would say that leading up to chapter 12, where it gets into the event of 9/11 itself, the first 11 or so chapters are dealing with a history of, like I said, imperialism's repressive apparatus that places 9/11 and its aftermath on a broader timeline. This is to say that, according to Scott, there are a series of events and processes that we have to look at before we start to understand an event like 9/11. And these essentially, to boil it down to one specific theme, it has to do with what the United States and the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, the list goes on, what they were conceivably willing to do and what they did do in order to defeat communism and revolutionary movements. When you start to look into what is publicly available, which again is limited, we start to see some plots that were only suggested and some as well that were actualized. So in terms of, for instance, the United States, as we know, in the late 1950s, early 1960s, the National Security Establishment, whatever you want to call it, develops something of an obsession with Cuba and Fidel Castro once they understand, okay, that he's a dedicated communist. So one thing that actually became available only in the 90s that Peter Dale Scott is able to work into this overall narrative he's presenting of the U.S. state is that the Joint Chief of Staff had considered, under the name of Operation Northwoods and then under the broader name of Operation Mongoose, these kind of secret attacks on the Cuban Revolution, had showed interest in false flag operations, and even going so far as to carry out, in their own words, terrorist attacks on U.S. locations in Florida, for example. and blaming them on the Cuban Revolution so as to manufacture consent for a land invasion of Cuba. There are other examples that Scott is able to bring up. For instance, if we look later on, and what's interesting about the book and reason I suggest it is, as you follow Scott through the late 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and so on, what you start to see is that a lot of the personnel and a lot of the relationships actually start to become repeated. You know, you see a lot of the same names come up again and again, but, you know, in one group that might have been working against revolutionary movement in Laos in the 60s would again emerge in the 1980s as part of Iran-Contra to defeat revolutionary movements in El Salvador and Nicaragua. So again, you see the similar events. So if we take Operation Northwoods as an example, this is a path that was not pursued because Kennedy nixed the idea. But you see other kind of this thinking develop again, is sort of to create some sort of violent collision event in a state of emergency to bring down the repressive apparatus. So what I was getting at in the context of the 1980s in Iran-Contra is, you know, Scott talks in detail about how during those hearings, there was open kind of a questioning of Oliver North by a Texas senator named Jack Brooks about this report that had come out in the Miami Herald of something called Readiness Exercise 1984, which would have been the use of federal camps managed in this case by FEMA to be able to put essentially those they would look at as quote unquote destabilizing excess populations. So that would be refugees moving north from United States wars in Central America. And it would also include political dissidents. And the idea of what was going on there was that the U.S. empire had come up against certain limits of what it could do because of the combined opposition against the U.S. war on Vietnam, as well as the treatment of Black people in the United States. So that ends up leading to a series of congressional overview. And as a result, the U.S. war state, let's say, is limited in being able to carry out direct land invasions. And so there becomes this interest, such as in Readiness Exercise 1984, to be able to use a crisis, create a state of emergency so that the United States once again might be able to carry out large-scale land invasions without overwhelming opposition. I think in this case, what's emphasized is domestically. So these are the sort of things he's looking at, this, again, this genealogy of the state leading up to 9/11. Of course, this also gets into detail about the U.S. wars during that same period, the 80s and 90s in Central Asia, where they're willing to, you know, Brzezinski's plan to support what I would say are the equivalent of right-wing Contra forces there against the Soviet Union. So again and again, you see these themes. And I would say the way I'm reading it, and not always how Peter Steele Scott is presenting it, is there is a desire to stamp out revolutionary movements that is arrayed against those movements both domestically and globally.
It's interesting you mentioned Brzezinski, because you made a point earlier about this kind of, you spot these continuities within imperialist planning and actions, and you spot continuities of personnel. And what comes to my mind when you mention Brzezinski is the fact that the man who made the peace agreement with the Taliban recently last year, Zalmay Khalilzad, he basically started his career working under Brzezinski, and as virtually continuously since the late 1970s held a series of senior positions within the US empire, basically. So the continuity of these figures, regardless of who is in power, speaks to that point you made about spotting exactly that continuities.
There are a lot of examples like that that stand out in the book. I mean, for instance, you know, the fact we've had these extensive media campaigns around the killing of just Jamal Khashoggi, right? this embassy in Turkey. And it was actually by reading this book that I found out who his uncle was, that his uncle was a major arms dealer with these extensive contacts in the U.S. state. And even with people like Donald Trump, he sold Donald Trump, either sold or bought a yacht, a big ship from Donald
Adnan, Trump. Adnan Khashoggi, I think his name is.
Yeah, Adnan is his uncle, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, you do see these relationships come out time and again.
To go back to Scott's book, you've already alluded to it to some extent, but how do you personally, from your political perspective, assess his argument, and what do you think he gets right and wrong in your opinion? Right and wrong may be the wrong terms, but how do you assess his argument? And also, I think maybe you can also talk more about his argument as well.
Yeah.
In doing that.
Well, I would say that I have critiques of his political framework, I would say. So how he understands what's going on is that there's this ongoing battle between the public and the secretive state, and that the public state has been forced to recede, and the secret state has gotten too big. So, and of course, I think about it a little bit differently. I mean, I think that as long as capitalist imperialism exists and there is need for this malfeasance in order to get the public to do what you want to do, there is going to be a need for the secretive apparatus. Now, that doesn't mean I don't think talking about something like the deep state or so on. I mean, we could change the terminology because of the way it's been appropriated, but there does remain this need to talk about this massive, massive infrastructure that has no public overview or public accountability system whatsoever. I mean, so if you live in the United States, you're paying for the CIA to do whatever it wants to do, and you know nothing about it. But of course, the way that I would look at it from a tactical and strategic perspective is that you push the public state as sort of one possible weapon in an arsenal against the capitalist imperialist state as a whole, if that makes sense. But I would say that from there are a couple of differences between Peter Dale Scott's perspective and what would be a Marxist or a communist perspective on things. One of them is that there is a tendency in his work to begin an understanding of imperialism's repressive apparatus, which is a term I'm using and not him. So that automatically tells you kind of what the differences might be. But he begins his story, I guess, after 1945 and the National Security Act and things like this. And I think that there is a need to understand that this state was constructed through some form of violent primitive accumulation. So in other words, the U.S. war state begins with a war for land against the native population on the American continent. And that these connections are important to draw out as well, because when you start to look at after the Second World War, families, including the Bush family themselves, families that were in a position of influence and power, you can trace them back to colonial industries and colonial enterprises, whether that might be the war for land, that might be the mass enslavement of African people, or which is the case with the Bush family or others. So I think that that's an important point of inquiry that he does not really seek to address. Now, there's also this other aspect of it is Scott is not necessarily, because he's concerned with the future of the United States, not necessarily as a people, but as a political regime. He fails. He does not therefore write from a perspective of solidarity with revolutionary movements that want to defeat or overthrow U.S. power, right? So this is this is somewhat important in a couple ways. I mean, in one sense, his understanding, I guess he might use words like justice and democracy to describe liberation movements, but I'll just refer to these movements in my terms, or in the broad left terms, is if you take a look at how he understands the repressive apparatus moving into place. So he's looking at something like Readiness Exercise 1984 as a way to respond to the presence of dissidents. And he traces that development back to the U.S. Army's response to the 60s Black uprisings, right? So this is very important because I do understand both something like Readiness Exercise 1984 or one repressive measure that rather repressive system even that is put in place after 9/11. I do understand that to be a response to domestic uprisings such as the Black Liberation Movement. But I would add to Scott's argument is that things like the travel restrictions of the Patriot Act and also the legal doctrines that are put in place to justify the concept of the war on terror were also a direct response to the internationalism and the world revolutions of the 20th century. So I would talk about how, you know, if we talk about the world in the 60s and 70s and 80s, where you might have people, revolutionaries, moving from one context to another, and that this movement is enabled by unprecedented levels of speed in international travel, so that you might end up with Palestinian revolutionaries sharing knowledge with revolutionaries in El Salvador, and then vice versa, Salvador revolutionaries fighting for the Palestinian revolution in Lebanon. What we see here is a promise of a better world premised on practical internationalism. That is, it's not internationalism that we need to sort of dream up or imagine, because it actually exists. The people who took part in those global revolutions actually felt them. And so the restrictions on movement, as well as some of the domestic civil liberties that were curtailed after 9/11, were explicitly designed to cut off these connections, to create a legal framework that prevents that from happening again. And so I think that this is an important part of the story, I guess, extending from 9/11 that is not addressed in Scott's book. Again, because it's just not in his interest. I mean, his, just to give you an idea, when he finally gets to the realm of prescription, which is where I depart with him entirely, he is advocating that people imitate solidarity in Poland, for example. But yeah, I mean, that gives you some idea. Whereas I look at it as, well, how about, I don't know, the Palestinian Liberation Movement, you know? How about people who are actually arrayed against and have been the victims of U.S. power and its most violent incarnations?
Now seems like an opportune time to address the slight elephant in the room, which is some of the difficulties around discussing 9/11 itself, because obviously it's a very contentious issue and many people, lamentably, including many on the left, can be extremely disparaging towards those who may question the accuracy and the veracity of the official narrative. And I often think about an interview with the aforementioned author of Operation Gladio, Daniele Ganser, in which he's asked about 9/11. And I think he's speaking in about 2016. And he says, you know, because of the nature of his expertise in 2001, in 2002, in 2003, in 2004, he was repeatedly asked about it. And he said, basically, as a historian, it's my position that it's too early to say anything with much confidence. But I think he eventually relented. I think, according to what he said in the interview, I think around 2004, he wrote an article in the Swiss press. And he basically, the point of his, I don't think he even drew any conclusions in the article, but he basically said, look, there are three main competing theories regarding what happened on 9/11. There's the official story, which is one of supposed intelligence failures and potential incompetence, missed opportunities, etc., whereby Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and the 19 hijackers are responsible. The US was surprised and nothing could have been done to stop them. And that's that. And obviously, as we know, that is the overwhelmingly dominant narrative in virtually all mainstream media, certainly in the English language, and across much of the West generally, I would say. The second is the so-called let it happen on purpose theory, which posits that Bush, Cheney, and others knew of the plot and essentially allowed it to happen because they knew it provided a convenient excuse and pretext for plans that they had already made. The third is what he calls, I think, the made it happen on purpose theory, which is probably the most controversial and most ridiculed, which is that contrary to the second theory, the certain US officials didn't just allow the plot to take place, but were actively involved in its formulation and delivery for their own ends. And the attacks were essentially false flag terror attacks, equatable to those that we know took place as part of Operation Gladio during the Cold War. Now, of course, lending any credence whatsoever publicly to theory two or three basically immediately invites ridicule or worse, and in some way, in some instances, can be kind of career or respectability suicide. And in, I remember in that interview, Ganser says how I think within hours of that article being published, the US embassy in Switzerland had complained to the paper that published it and called Ganser a conspiracy theorist. And so as we know, anyone really who does question that official narrative is immediately, especially in the US context, labeled a 9/11 truther. And for quite a few years, I've been extremely interested in the power of that pejorative label and how successfully the desire to avoid being labeled a 9/11 truther has essentially in many, and I'm not talking just mainstream here, even within quote unquote leftist, but broadly defined circles, has largely shut down public debate on one of the most important, however, whatever theory you think is true or accurate, you know, undoubtedly an extremely crucial, important turning point in modern history, basically, is just not really discussed openly and honestly and critiqued like other things are. And, you know, some of the kind of typical reactions you get, even including from people on the left, are this kind of negative connotation of conspiracy theories, associating it with figures like Alex Jones, which is something you mentioned in your review, and just immediately kind of pouring scorn or inviting ridicule on people that do question it. Alternatively, there are people that might entertain the notion that the official narrative is not accurate or true, but then they'll quickly switch to a kind of, well, what does it even matter kind of attitude. So what if it was an inside job? Why does it matter? There are more important things, you know, it happened. There are more important things to establish. So this is a very long-winded way of me saying that for me, Peter Dale Scott, so I've read the book since your review, or almost all of it. And for me, he makes a very convincing case for 9/11 being an inside job, basically. We can discuss the details of that later, but he makes a very convincing case, in my opinion. So to someone, what would you say, I guess, to someone who says either A, you're a conspiracy theorist fool for even considering that, or B, well, what does it even matter? How would you respond to that?
Okay, so you put two premises forward. The first is that this line of inquiry is loony conspiracy theory territory. And the second being, okay, let's say that there was a cover-up of some kind on what exactly happened on 9/11 and what led to 9/11. What does it really matter? And I think I want to address both of those in turn. On the first question of conspiracy theory territory, I've been kind of interested for a while on what might be considered conspiracy theory and what might not be by the press. And of course, since the rise of QAnon, there's been this sort of attempt to say that if you doubt any series, any number of things about official U.S. claims about what happens in the world, that basically puts you into the territory of this sort of right-wing movement. So here's what I say about the general effort to sort of discredit, let's say, a doubt or skepticism about the official claims of the state. Typically, an article will come out. And the article, before it ever even attempts to deal with whatever the claims are in question or what even the nature of the subject matter in question. So let's say it's something like 9/11, or let's say it's something like JFK assassination or whatever else. What they'll often do in the bourgeois press is to wheel out some sort of psychoanalysis expert who will come out and say, well, you know, the reason that this person, that people don't believe the things that we tell them to believe are essentially that the world is a difficult, inscrutable place and they can't make sense out of the mystery. And so they resort to conspiracy theory as a sort of coping mechanism. And what I'm going to say about this is that this is used as, generally speaking, a stalling tactic to prevent any examination of the empirical record. Because I do believe that any of these cases, for instance, you're talking about Peter Dale Scott's book, if people were to look at chapters 12, 13, and 14 especially, that they would be very intrigued by what they might find. But you got to get them to read it first. But if you tell people that by reading that these chapters in question, you might be engaged in some sort of coping mechanism to make sense out of a deeply inscrutable universe, then you might kind of ward them off. And sort of the way I look at it is, if you actually take a look at the empirical record, you might be surprised by what you find and what's going on in my brain and whatever my coping mechanisms are, or whether I hate my parents and that's why I do this, and whatever else you're trying to come up with. It's all going to be irrelevant, right? Because it's the ultimate form of ad hominem, except on this mass scale, because anybody who's coming to this subject matter, say, we doubt the U.S. government's claim, is automatically put into this category. And what's funny about that is that, you know, there's even sort of official terms that they come up with. I mean, people who are interested in this, I might suggest you look at somebody's work named Cass Sunstein. Now, Cass Sunstein is sort of an unscrupulous figure who actually in 2002 had argued in favor of Bush's legal authority for the military tribunals that he was setting up globally. But what he actually put out in recent years is a paper that argues explicitly that conspiracy theorists are pose an inherent threat to the domestic order. And the actual specific example he uses is the 9/11 theories, because he says basically it has in common, there's a lot of people in the United States who believe that there was some sort of U.S. government involvement, and that he also singles out quote-unquote Muslim countries because they don't believe the story. And you can see that the case that he's trying to make in this draft he put out called conspiracy theories. So they come up with some sort of phrase for what we're engaged in if we doubt the U.S. government, and basically refers to it. What exactly is the phrase? That we have a broken epistemology. And the suggestion here is, you know, when civil liberties are eroded, I essentially find this incoherent, I'll say. But what he's saying is, when civil liberties are eroded, people tend to get their information from too few of sources. And this is why they come up with these crazy theories. Now, I think it's actually probably something like, the opposite of that more information sources lead to more skepticism about the ruling order. But this idea of a broken epistemology, you can see they're always ready to give it some new phrase. You know what I'm saying? It'd be like that we have some sort of, next they'll be making the claim that we have a degenerate cognition or some shit like that, you know.
The
list could go on and on. But again, what I would suggest is that we come down to looking at the actual empirical record, just getting through the door on that before we move next. And there's actually an author who dealt with, what we're up against with this claim of conspiracy theory. His name is Graham McQueen. And I suggest people to actually go out and read a book by him called The 2001 Anthrax Deception. Because he, right from the get-go, he knows that he's going to be accused, simply by virtue of what he's looking into, of engaging in conspiracy theory. He says a couple interesting things. The first one, he takes on this claim that if you believe that the U.S. government had some sort of hand in an event like 9/11, or what he's looking in more detail at, these anthrax attacks who've been memory hold since then. He's saying that if you are interested in that, people might accuse you of believing in some sort of cabals or supernatural forces that steer history. So this is something that the Wall Street Journal did very recently as well with this article. They had 9/11 and the rise of the new conspiracy theorists. And what they do is compare 9/11 theories to theories about Masons, Catholics, or Jewish people trying to control the world and manipulate the world through covert means. But of course, if we think about this for 2 seconds, we can recognize right away the fallacy at hand here. That is, to have theories about the specific actions or behaviors or even doubts about the claims of figures like in institutions like the Bush administration, the CIA, or the FBI, are claims made about actually existing organizations and people. So this would not be similarly true of making claims about Masons, Catholics, Jewish people who are united either by religious or ethnic ties. So you couldn't claim them to be any kind of coherent organization of any kind. So, in other words, believing something specific about the nature of the JFK assassination or 9/11 does not necessarily mean automatically, it does not consign you to any sort of belief about Masons, Catholics, Jewish people, or whatever else. So, instantly, that we know this is a fallacy. Next thing that we could sort of address is this accusation of the conspiracy theory of history. So if you believe in any specific conspiracy theory, that means you hold this conspiracy theory of history and are blind to the broader, more abstract structural forces that move history. But again, this is false. And McQueen makes this comparison where he says, if you and I were to talk about, let's say, the Black Death or the plague in Europe, we thought this was a major event that had a huge impact on the course of history. By making that statement alone, we wouldn't be resigned to a quote-unquote disease theory of history, right? So in other words, just because diseases happen and they are significant does not mean that they're the only thing that happened, the only thing that is significant. And that is the same about any particular event like 9/11. The final point that he makes that I think is worth considering, and this is a really big one because I think this gets to the political heart of the matter and why these there is a sort of hysteria around this stuff, but only among specific demographics. Because I mean, you've traveled around a bit. You know, if you go, you could go around the world and suggesting that the Bush administration had something to do with 9/11 would not shock most people. It shocks people in the certain upper echelons of thought production in the United States. But yeah, exactly. So, but to just get to this final point about conspiracy theories is that when it comes to a topic like 9/11, okay, it's not exactly like the JFK assassination, where there is a debate about whether there was a lone wolf or a conspiracy. That's the debate there. At 9/11, there's actually no debate about conspiracy, okay? Because the official story is itself a conspiracy explanation, except the conspiracy is, at one time it was limited to Al-Qaeda, and then later on it was Saudi Arabia was brought in. So I've noticed that over the past 20 years, by the way, that actually you can impute all kinds of acts of conspiracy. You can make all sorts of accusations if it pertains to Saudi Arabia now. But it's actually the moment where you expand the possibility of conspiracy to involve the U.S. state and not just Al-Qaeda or Saudi Arabia, that's when the accusation of trutherism comes up. That's when you are a conspiracy theorist. But why should that apply to, why is the CIA or the Bush administration afforded this kind of protection and discussions so that they should be walled off and that once you start to venture into what their activities are, you're involved in conspiracy theory? What trust have they earned against the Saudi monarchy, for example? So I think that this is an important point. It's not actually turning a non-conspiracy explanation into a conspiracy explanation. It's looking at, it's whether you want to go into the giant U.S. state, war state, as being implicated in that conspiracy or not. Now, you made another important point, I think, when it comes to, you know, does it really matter what happened on 9/11? And I actually, when people say this, you know, they'll say something like, oh, yeah, well, what does it change? What does it matter? And I'll think to myself, I mean, it's specious in the most literal sense, because when you start thinking about it for a few moments, you're like, well, why does it matter? I mean, there's a series of things that it's like asking, you know, why does the Reichstag fire matter? Or, you know, to bring it closer to home, why does the Gulf of Tonkin incident actually matter? Why do any of these things matter? And so I'll explain why I think that they do. Is that I believe it is a political mistake from an anti-imperialist perspective to put a casus belli, that is an impetus for war, as important as 9/11, in a category apart from what we know about imperial and colonial rule all over the world. So just to draw a parallel example. In the north of Ireland, occupied six counties in the north of Ireland, we understand that cover-ups and sabotage, and we could give many different examples. I mean, we could just start out with the killings in Ballymurphy, the Ballymurphy massacre. Those have characterized the nature of the colonial occupation in Ireland, because again, they are dealing with, you know, something like the Force Research Unit. They're dealing with a secretive unit dedicated to defeating, liquidating, and destroying the revolutionary movement in Ireland. And people have responded by deciding, because in a place like Ireland, there's a strong link between the civil rights and civil liberties movement that is above ground and the revolutionary movement that is underground, that the above ground movement has concerned itself with trying to establish a truthful record about British colonial atrocities in the north of Ireland. And so the families that have been looking to seek for the truth and have it publicly validated in the case of Ballymurphy that the British troops had fired on people in the neighborhood without being fired on themselves. This has become very important to establish because it's part of establishing the moral and historical record, and thus our moral and historical case against imperialism and colonialism. So that being the case, there is some agreement, if you want to commit yourself to being a quote-unquote Ballymurphy truther, that the truth actually matters. And so that's what makes the trutherism pejorative so puzzling, is because you say, well, the truth, we disagree with the ruling class about the nature of the truth. The ruling class decides that myth can supersede truth, especially in a case like 9/11. And we are saying, no, the truth actually matters because this increases our understanding of the order and the institutions which we're forced to live under.
Yeah. I always find it hilarious that the word truther, i.e. someone who is in, wants to find out the truth, has so easily become such a negative and basically insulting or demeaning label. I find that fascinating in itself. And I think, honestly, even I felt this even before Peter Dale Scott's book, and I think his book really just kind of confirmed it to me, is what I can say with absolute confidence. And I feel like I don't know how anyone, any honest, logical, rational person, when presented with the official narrative and the broader historical context, which Scott outlined so usefully, but also the more specific, for want of a better word, holes in that narrative. No one in their right mind can accept that as a believable, serious explanation of those events. And I believe that wholeheartedly. As Ganser and others have said, where you then move, where your position moves to then after that, is that's a somewhat of a different question. But for me, the official narrative is clearly absurd. Sorry, go on.
I would just like to say about that point is that if we sort of allow ourselves to back up in history a bit, let's back up to before the days when the word truther was invented by whoever as a media term and a pejorative. If we want to understand the reason why a 9/11 truth movement started in the first place, it's because, and this is actually, I think, when we think back on those years, particularly the Bush era, it's easy to assume a sort of narrative of what took place. But when you actually start to go back through the record, it's astonishing by what might come out by looking at it in chronological order. So the reason that a movement for 9/11 truth started was because there never actually was, in the first place, a basic investigation to establish evidence for the U.S. government's claims, okay? So what I mean by that is literally, days after September 11th in 2001, there was this joint resolution put through in Congress called the Authorization for Use of Military Force. And essentially what this resolution did, well, first I'll read the actual words and then I'll kind of talk about what I think it allowed to happen. It says, in general, that the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, and persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or persons. So, and this is a point that Graham McQueen makes in his book that's very important, is if you look at it, you want to talk about broken epistemology, to get back to Sunstein. By the way, Sunstein, who I was talking about, who wants to go after 9/11 truthers, is the husband of Samantha Power. So people listening to this might know, might know a little something about her and her importance in setting up the quote-unquote humanitarian responsibility to protect framework that has been, you know, brought to destroy Serbia, Libya in 2011. But anyways, to get back to this, talking about broken epistemologies, here's a broken epistemology because essentially this, epistemologically speaking, it allows President Bush to decide who did 9/11 before a formal investigation was even established. So in other words, the very belief that it was Al-Qaeda who was behind it came from no other source than Bush himself. And the reason why there was subsequent investigations, including the 9/11 Commission report, which, you know, I think Peter Dale Scott shows its flagrant omissions and contradictions pretty well towards the end of his book. The reason why that commission came about in the first place was because the families of people who were killed in those attacks demanded it. They demanded it against the desires of the U.S. government.
That's it's a crucial point.
It's a crucial point. So, in other words, what you think you know about who did what, it was never even established on an open basis with evidence in the first place. And the reason people's interest, let's also remember why people got interested in the first place. People got interested because there were certain claims that the U.S. government made that were transparently outrageous. So, for example, the claim that, this is just a very simple one, that Satom El-Sukami, who had his passport found at the site of Ground Zero where the towers had fallen, the fact that there was this intact passport there, it essentially, it's one of these claims that you hear and that people who might not think about them because there's a million different things happening in the news day, they nod their head, they say, oh, okay, so they got them. They got the guy. But actually, when you're sitting there, you might just be like waiting in public sometime and you're just going over different things in your mind. And then all of a sudden you land on that claim and you're thinking back to yourself, wait a minute. How does that make any sense? How was an intact passport to be found? And the reason why I think that particular claim is something that we should remember is because if you don't memory hole things, if you try to collect the evidence of what is claimed about what happens and what happens, then you start to notice certain patterns. So to relate back to this passport, in 2015, there was this ISIS bombing in Paris. Do you remember that? Yeah. Do you also remember that they reported that the suicide bomber had an intact passport found at the site of the bombing? Yeah. Okay. So you know that we're about one explosion away from being able to refer to this as the old passport trick. I mean,
I also remember, I'm not sure if it was the 2015 attack, but there was an attack in France where one of the people who was named as one of the assailants saw himself on TV being named as one of the assailants as it was ongoing, and immediately went to the nearest police station to hand himself in, basically, and say, look, I'm being called on the news that I'm doing this, that I'm there, and I'm not. And that reminded me of the fact that in the immediate aftermath of the naming of the hijackers, several of them turned up around the world alive. And for me, those I can't actually remember if Dale Scott mentions those instances.
He does mention it, yeah, because it ends up becoming. You want to talk about establishing patterns? He actually made an association about that with his work on the JFK assassination to say that they knew who did it right away.
Yeah,
the same pattern. Yeah,
I mean, actually, that's one thing I'm not sure if we've said explicitly, but Peter Dale Scott has also written a book on the assassination of JFK.
Yeah, a few.
To which Chomsky has for a long time been disparaging of, and him falling into that camp of what does it matter, basically.
Yeah, what does it matter about this? Essentially, I mean, if that was a conspiracy to assassinate JFK, it would be a legal means used to establish a coup because you bring a new power circle into a new circle into power. So, I mean, would we say about any coup d'etat, it doesn't matter? No.
Exactly.
And again, this is serious politics. This is not a matter of, I know how Chomsky tries to argue it. It's like, oh, JFK's just, why is he more important than anybody else in the world? Well, I mean, in a political sense and trying to understand the system, he was the president of the United States. You know, yeah. We're not saying that, like, the life is inherently more valuable. This is confusing political analysis with sort of
morality.
Moralistic. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I wondered if you wanted to move away from Scott's book slightly.
Do you mind if I just say one thing about this idea that this is a right-wing concern?
Of course, go for it.
Yeah, I really wanted to be clear about this because you mentioned Alex Jones. I find Alex Jones to be a very suspicious figure on many levels because he's a little bit different in terms of a right-wing media figures from what had come before. In terms of, okay, you're going to go listen to Rush Limbaugh, and Rush Limbaugh is essentially producing hate speech against the usual targets of women, refugees, and whoever else. So it's fairly recognizable. Whereas I think what Alex Jones did, what his whole shtick was basically to kind of take on the branding or the trappings of the archetypal sort of 60s truth teller and essentially fascize it. So instead of really producing, like, for years, just to give an example, he had talked about FEMA camps rounding people up. Well, the problem that he presents there for people who want to understand U.S. imperialism is that he was talking about a real historical phenomenon. That after 9/11, once ICE is established and Department of Homeland Security is established, actually do end up creating these camps, except the camps were targeting refugees from U.S. wars in Central America primarily, right? So if he's going to make the transition to claim that those refugees are quote-unquote invaders of the United States, the problem he presents us is that he's presented a real historical record that typically the liberal press would not be willing to touch. But with that historical record, ends up fomenting hostility and animosity on a racist basis. So that's very dangerous. But it's also important to understand the process at work there. And on this question that this is that looking a line of inquiry in the United States has somehow this is the purview of the right, so to speak. I would respond like this: that first of all, I don't believe it did necessarily begin with the right. I believe that if we remember and think back of what it was like in the Bush era, that this was, especially for Arab and Muslim communities in the United States, this was a very terrifying, nausea-inducing time, right? But since I'm an internationalist, I mean, I'm definitely doomed to be optimistic in a certain sense. So I actually found its earlier incarnations, thinking about it in hindsight, was something to be optimistic about, because it was people, politically what it was people making a statement to say to the Bush administration. So one political role I think that the 9/11 truth served in the immediate wake of 2001 was it was a way of expressing broad skepticism and hatred of the Bush administration specifically, and sometimes U.S. imperialism more broadly, depending on who was expressing the sentiment. So it was a way of saying, fuck you, in a time of emergency state. So it's a way of saying, we do not believe you in a time of induced emergency. And so what I would say is, while it's very true, and I think it's very clear, that there's no direct pipeline from an interest in 9/11 to revolutionary politics, there is no doubt going to be interest and doubts about official claims of the state once there's crises of legitimacy. And in turn, that broad skepticism of Bush helped create the crisis of legitimacy in the first place. So in other words, a crisis of legitimacy might not necessarily create a revolution, but a revolution necessarily entails a crisis of legitimacy. And so in that crisis of legitimacy, I think that, that's exactly what I'm doing, is that I do think that the state behaves on a nefarious basis to foment violence to carry out broader aims. But we want to be specific about the class exploitation and racist oppression at the heart of that project. But of course, that adds to another reason of why it might be important to look at malfeasance and covert operations, because whether we're talking about 9/11 or whether we're talking about U.S. supplies to right-wing groups in any given context, if the U.S. state and U.S. imperialism is capable of fronting its operations with quote-unquote brown faces that it's going to demonize, then we would want to know about it, because this helps us to make a case against its racist scapegoats It helps it carry out its class aims.
Exactly. Did you want to maybe discuss, as you see it, moving away from Scott's book, the consequences of 9/11, both domestically and globally?
Yeah, absolutely. What I think I'll do then is just build on how I understand the function, the role served by the Patriot Act and the War on Terror. What we end up seeing, I think, on a broad and general basis, is the demonization of millions of people, Arabs, Muslims, of course, the denigration, outright, let's say, erasure of their rights, in order to facilitate a series of large-scale operations or to erode sovereignty around the globe, right? So that might secure the economic hegemonic aims of the Cheney-Rumsfeld set and their desire to be able to get over using the state of emergency and 9/11 as casus belli, the quote-unquote Vietnam syndrome. And the Vietnam syndrome was this idea that it would be too costly in terms of the political crisis it might create to actually do direct military engagement in all of these target nations, okay? So that is one way I think we would understand it. That's the generalized broad basis. But I also think there were not just broad targets of state violence in this case, but there were also specific targets that the unifying theme to me behind these specific targets is that there had been long attempts to quote-unquote undo the legacy of the 60s. I mean, this is something that you definitely find as a through line through the Reagan era and how they began to prosecute quote-unquote political violence and use that prosecution with grand jury against, for instance, Puerto Rican liberation organizations and communist organizations as well in the United States. So to give some specific examples of what I mean by specific targets, on the domestic front, and remember there's both a domestic and global aspect to this, but on the domestic front, there was actually before September 11th, a targeting in the year 2000 of Jameel El-Amin, who was formerly H-Rat Brown, with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee as well as the Black Panther Party. And the War on Terror laws were, and this is something I've actually spoken about on East of is a podcast before, these laws were instrumentalized to go after supporters of his in Detroit, Michigan, with ultimately leading to the assassination by the FBI of Luqman Abdullah, who was had his own mosque that served the poor and preached as in one of the poorest sections of the west side of Detroit, preached political recalcitrance as is not only their right but the duty at living in under the colonial boot of U.S. imperialist rule. And so essentially I looked at that and the movement that came to support Luqman Abdullah, they said they called it a COINTELPRO remix and said it's a Patriot Act thing. So that's a very, in the figure of Amin, looking to take out a strong link to 60s and 70s Black revolutionary nationalism thought and action. On an international front, what we started to see besides, what I was talking about with these new regime limitations on travel and using terrorism, because terrorism could be anything, that's exactly the point, as a means to stop revolutionary liberation movements globally from working with each other, from meeting with each other. So you would have things like Aviation and Transportation Security Act, as well as the new terror funding laws, which and then the global military tribunals, which basically says, okay, we can go anywhere we want and snatch up anybody we want, but there's no actual need to provide any evidence, and there's no evidence presented on a basis where people might compare it to what else they have. So that allows the United States to target certain liberation movements. And if we look at the dates after 2001 of different organizations that are added to the quote-unquote FDO list, the Foreign Terrorist Organization list, we see things like the Communist Party of the Philippines, the New People's Army, which is added in August of 2002. We see Real IRA, Continuity IRA, added late 2001 and then 2004, respectively. We see, of course, the PFLP and the PFLP-GC liberation organizations in Palestine have been added earlier in 97 in response to their refusal to comply with the Oslo regime of subjugation and pacification in Palestine. And then in the 2000s, we also see things like, you know, under the aegis of Plan Colombia, the illegal kidnapping, the arrest of Simón Trinidad with the FARC. And you see targets like these. So if we're talking about liberation movements in Palestine, Philippines, and Colombia, they dovetail more or less with domestic targets of these programs in, the targeting of the anti-war 23, which I think people should look up, is a case of using the Reagan infrastructure of a grand jury against anti-war activists. And then from there, the targeting of Palestine solidarity activists becomes sort of a major part of the crackdowns extending from that case. So you see all of this in addition to the broad racist crackdowns, the unleashing of FBI informants into Arab and Muslim neighborhoods in order to create distrust, paranoia of within strong communities of each other. This weakens their ability to create, or at least adds an extra obstacle to creating a powerful political bloc on a community basis to oppose a whole new set of wars.
And beyond that, something I wanted to discuss is something that you mentioned when we were discussing this episode, which is this idea of the period of mega imperialism, the concept of a Moroccan thinker. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that how we understand what ended up happening in the aftermath of September 11th is that you have an attempt to rework the domestic and international legal framework that planners in the United States imperialist apparatus had found to be a nuisance to all-out control, or what they began to call full-spectrum dominance. And the fronts on which, let's say, U.S. imperialism was beaten back against this idea that it could just invade any country it wants at any time to do whatever it wants, that was really the legacy of revolutionary movements globally, spearheaded really by the Vietnamese Revolution, but done on a global basis and in the United States itself against to constrain U.S. power. And of course, what Cheney, Rumsfeld, and the rest openly admitted that what they were trying to do, you know, through Project for New American Century and other kind of think tanks like this, is to say we want a new era, which we could use in their wording, a new Pearl Harbor, to rework the legal system so we can get rid of nuisances like the rule of law and invade wherever we want. And then once we invade wherever we want, we can snatch up whoever we want. And then once we snatch up whoever we want, we don't even need to read the charges against them. I mean, it's hard to imagine a exercise of power that is more absolute than this. And that was something that, if there's one way to describe this window of time in the 2000s after 2001, I think it is this concept of mega imperialism, which I saw expressed when I was in the Library of Congress going through some documents. It was expressed by Mehdi El Manjra, who was this Moroccan thinker who referred to this idea of basically what we could call carte blanche of the U.S. as because, you know, when we talk about civil rights, civil liberties and things like this, you know, if you are a political revolutionary, you're not going to lean on those completely. Because a lot of times the laws are unjust. The example being in Jim Crow South, it would have been a moral thing to not respect the laws of segregation. But on the other hand, it's important to establish a standard that would prevent the United States or any other imperialist state or entity from basically being able to crush any liberation movement because people don't have any rights for any form of political dissent. And so this was a very important, to me, the civil liberties and civil rights that were disintegrated were very important because it says laws apply to you, they don't apply to us. And so it's a statement of we can do whatever we want to you at any time. And so in elaborating the concept of mega-imperialism, Mantra ended up describing the concept of humiliation. And humiliation is an extension of absolute hegemony, absolute control. He describes it as both a form of government and a pattern of managing societies. That essentially is what I'm talking about here. The United States of America practices humiliation in all countries of the world in this period. And he describes it as a form of fascism because it doesn't leave any room for tolerance and respect. And it's a destructive weapon directed against human dignity. And he thought that the only way out, and you know, for those Arab and Muslim majority nations would have to be to resort to intifada against the U.S.-led world order. But what he was talking about, this all-encompassing form of imperialism, was that the United States' dominance in the world after September 11 was not driven by respect. It was rather fear-driven. So a big part of his critique is looking at the Moroccan government's crackdown on quote-unquote Islamists and essentially how both the language and the mechanisms of crackdown were imitating directives of the United States on a global scale to a T at that time. So this is the total erosion of rights and liberties coincides, of course, necessarily with the erosion of the right of national sovereignty. So in other words, it was like what we were seeing at that time was a global counter-revolutionary reign of terror. And I actually, when I read this theory of mega imperialism, I thought it had a lot of tie-in with Hezbollah's 2009 manifesto, which people could actually read in. You could probably find it online if you haven't read it. But it, essentially what it was looking at was this moment after 2011 of U.S.-led domination and hegemony that showed that the U.S. was at its historic height of its powers as a result of the state of emergency induced by 9/11. And terrorism became the universal pretext to destroy resistance movements. And by the way, a big part of that destruction of resistance movements, a big part of the trick that the Foreign Terrorist Organization list was able to pull off is that you put liberation movements that are at opposing ends with movements like Al-Qaeda on the same list. And so, you know, one is as good as the other, even though they're, it appears that way, even though their goals for colonized nations and for the world are in many ways manifestly opposed.
Yeah, a very stark example of the completely cynical and political way those terrorist lists are used as well is provided by the fact that after 2001, or after September 11th, rather, the U.S., approached Hezbollah and basically offered renewed improved relations with the US and the removal of Hezbollah from the terrorist lists if in various things they asked for in return, but central to those requests was Hezbollah severing all links with the Palestinian resistance movement and severing links with Iran and Syria, other things as well. And of course, Hezbollah refused, but it shows the ways in which those, one way or another, those lists are used against liberation resistance movements. But sorry to interrupt, because I feel like you were moving towards the, when you, your mention of national sovereignty, it feels you were moving there towards perhaps discussing Afghanistan and Iraq, which obviously it would be remiss to discuss 9/11 without doing so.
Well, yeah, that I think that is the fact that there could be large-scale land invasions again was in a sense meant to, as the Project for Numeric and Century put it, was meant to essentially rejuvenate U.S. imperialism that they thought had been in some sense on the decline. And in those cases, what we see is a whole new set of lies constructed. There's first in the case of Afghanistan, which was that we're going to invade on the basis of that resolution I described earlier, which says, they came up with a whole new set of legal framework. What did the legal framework says? Okay, the president of the United States get to determine who did this without presenting evidence. Second, the president of the United States determines that whoever did this, you know, if they were hosted in a given country, that gives the right to invasion of that country. And then, of course, in the case of Iraq, we know that the lies told to invade that country were notoriously egregious, and relying on informants whose testimony was not only was it not available to the U.S. public, but in the case of Curveball, who was one of the informants that they were relying on for this WMD claim in Iraq, not even the U.S. government claimed to have access to his information because he was under German intelligence's dominion, you could say. So, and I think that really, when we think about what we would want to do in terms of political strategy, it should be motivated by solidarity with those millions who were assaulted, insulted, denigrated, killed, and or whose lives were destroyed in countries like Afghanistan and Iraq.
One thing that always comes to mind is a quote I read from Rumsfeld talking in 2001. I'm paraphrasing, but he was essentially asked what would victory look like in the war on terror? You know, what would constitute victory? And he basically says, you know, what would victory be? Victory would be persuading the American people and the rest of the world that this isn't something that's going to be over in a month or a year or even 5 years. And he goes on, and you know, he he's basically very candidly saying this is the war on terror is a means of justifying indefinite warfare, both to a U.S. audience and to the world. It's one of those kind of amazingly candid moments.
Yeah, I think that it becomes clear to us, at least from our vantage point in 2021, but I believe many did say it at the time, was that the United States not only needed a state of emergency to get over the quote-unquote Vietnam syndrome, but also to create a pretext to replace the old anti-communist pretext. And because of the fungibility of the word in question, of terrorism, which functionally speaking for the United States is the violence people we don't like do, in that case, yes, it did become the perfect rhetorical device, linguistic device for this invasion, this so-called right to invade anywhere. Do you mind if I just say one thing going back? I don't know, maybe this ends up getting hacked off or something, but on this point of 9/11 truth, another one of the major points that people try to bring up about it is, well, somebody would have said something, you know, that there's no conspiracy this large where somebody involves too many different actors' involvement for it to be able to persist in secret. And I just want to say that this answer, in answering this talking point that gets brought up, I am able to articulate exactly what I find interesting or important about the study of deep politics. And I want to be clear that I don't think you can study deep politics in isolation from other forms of theory, particularly Marxist theory about how wealth is created and expropriated. I want to be very clear about that, because I think without that theoretical understanding, that's where it can lead to some of these sort of more dubious movements. But what I did learn, I think, reading writers like Peter Dale Scott, is that when it comes to secrecy, the broader national security apparatus in the United States is designed to protect factionalism, and it is designed to uphold secrecy on a systemic basis. So the running principle of, just to take an example of one organization, the CIA, is secrecy and clandestinism, which by definition protects factionalism. So this means that not everybody working in within the system of secrecy may know much beyond their direct radius of concerns and orders that they're given or carrying out. So, and this is one reason why I don't bother to flatter one or the other alternatives between the possibility of state conspiracy and so what we would say a structural analysis. And that is because the covert arm of imperialism is exactly where conspiracy has become a structural feature. So in taking 9/11 as an example, is that you start to look into the relationships between the CIA and FBI and high-ranking members of Al-Qaeda throughout the years. And you see that certain assets are protected. Right. So you could look up just as an example, the FBI official Patrick Fitzgerald's relationship with Ali Muhammad, who was an important Al-Qaeda figure who had simultaneous roles within the CIA, the FBI, and even was a teacher at the U.S. Army, was trained by...
He taught at Fort Bragg, didn't he?
Yeah, at Fort Bragg, exactly. And so he received Green Beret training that apparently he then gave to Al-Qaeda. So if you look at that, you have a protected asset, and Patrick Fitzgerald is just carrying out protection of his asset, and a cover-up might then happen. In that case, that is what exactly was the relationship... you know, what kind of plea agreement or what kind of secret agreement was Muhammad given not to testify at a certain trial? This is getting into the weeds a bit, but just to offer up a concrete example, and we could see a cover up might happen on an institutional or a personal basis in participation on just one aspect of the total conspiracy. So to draw on another example about how secrecy it works within USD politics, is if you take Watergate, for example, Howard E. Hunt's explanation when he went public with what he was doing was to say that when he was doing things like breaking into the Watergate Hotel on behalf of the president on a secret operation, he thought that he was carrying out an agency directive. And he didn't know that it was a factional, i.e. belonging to Nixon, directive. But here's the issue that comes up. Either way, whether it was factional or agency directive, it was a top secret mission. So, you know, Howard Hunt was a pathological liar, so I'm not saying we should buy his explanation on anything, but the point is, when either way it's a top secret mission, who exactly can tell whether it was factional or belonging to, all the way to the top of the agency? You see the problem that comes in here. So in other words, this covert arm of imperialism is sustained by and run through conspiracy and secrecy. So it might be, if relationships and orders and directives are given on a need-to-know basis, it's not exactly that there's, you know, there might be somebody who holds all the pieces, or let alone hundreds, who hold all the pieces and are swearing to remain silent about the thing in its entirety.
Yeah. To go back to where we started to some extent, I would strongly encourage anyone who's interested in anything that we're talking about, perhaps initially to read your review of Peter Del Scott's book, which is on liberatedtext.com. But I was wondering if we could kind of conclude with you just giving you a kind of brief explanation of why should people read Peter Del Scott's book, basically. Why is it an important book, and why should people spend time reading it?
Well, I think in addition to what I've said already, I would just conclude by saying it's important for us to be able to create militant doubt about U.S. imperialism's claims and to know how to prove counterclaims. Because with these information systems we're confronting, we're up against a whole lot. And I did, in terms of the elephant in the room that you mentioned in pertaining to 9/11 itself, I did want to try to help to destigmatize that a bit. Because this again goes back to a prior point that I was making, but on the street, you know, among average people, this is not necessarily a outrageous claim, because how many working people in this world really believe the Bush administration? It's actually in centers of formal knowledge production that this stuff is very strictly guarded against. Don't go there.
That's completely matches my experience as well.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I think that we can draw from Peter Del Scott is a kind of methodology to be able to prove claims about the imperialist state that might otherwise seem outrageous. And to be able to empirically ground it arms us in multiple settings, including up against these propaganda systems. It arms us with knowledge, it arms us with information, and we should also take from that, even if we don't take the overall framework, which I don't think we should, we should also take from that the courage to militantly rebuke the state when it's saying something that we think is outrageous, unfounded, untrue, and which is serving an agenda of violent expropriation and destruction.
Absolutely. It's like Che Guevara said, never trust imperialism.
You know, that gets that really, in his special way, that distills everything I'm trying to say. Is whether, I mean, we might be asking ourselves, why is it that the honest liberal, with all of liberalism's own limitations and delusions about how power works, was willing to take on the grotesque likes of Bush and Cheney in a direct way many Marxists aren't? Is we need to be able to have a variety of oppositional research that that serves, that kind of coalesces into our broader movements.
Absolutely. So perhaps on that final note, I would implore people to read Patrick's brilliant review of Peter Del Scott's Road to 9/11, and also find the time to read the book itself. You certainly will be infinitely more informed on the events of 9/11 and their broader context. And I think if you read it with an open mind, you will almost certainly no longer believe the official narrative if you do at this current moment.
Oh, you know, by the way, you bring up Che. Fidel and Chavez didn't believe that official narrative either. So there's good company out there.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Thank you, Louis. I appreciate it.
Cheers, bro.
Cheers.
Man, you hear this bullshit they be talking every day, man. It's like these motherfuckers is just like professional liars, you know what I'm saying? Wow. Listen, Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects. It was your nigga. Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked.